In the early Neolithic period in Europe, it may be 10,000 or 12,000 years ago or so, man was differentiating all over the world, and he had already differentiated into a number of varieties, but he has never differentiated into different species. A species, we must remember, in biological language, is distinguished from a variety by the fact that varieties can interbreed, while species either do not do so or produce offspring which, like mules, are sterile. All mankind can interbreed freely, can learn to understand the same speech, can adapt itself to cooperation, and in the present age, man is probably no longer undergoing differentiation at all. Readmixture is now a far stronger force than differentiation. Men mingle more and more. Mankind, from the view of a biologist, is an animal species in a state of arrested differentiation and possible readmixture. Second, it's only in the last 50 or 60 years that the varieties of men came to be regarded in this light as a tangle of differentiations recently arrested or still in progress. Before that time, students of mankind, influenced consciously or unconsciously by the story of Noah and the Ark and his three sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth, were inclined to classify men into three or four great races, and they were disposed to regard these races as having always been separate things descended from original separate ancestors. They ignored the great possibilities of blended races and of special local isolations and variations. The classification has varied considerably, but there's been rather too much readiness to assume that mankind must be completely divisible into three or four main groups. Ethnologists, students of race, have fallen into grievous disputes about a multitude of minor peoples as to whether they were of this or that primary race or mixed or strayed early forms or what not, but all races are more or less mixed. There are no doubt four main groups, but each is a miscellany, and there are little groups that won't go into any of the four main divisions. Subject to these reservations, when it's clearly understood that when we speak of these main divisions we mean not simple and pure races but groups of races, then we have a certain convenience in discussion. Over the European and Mediterranean area and Western Asia there are, and have been for many thousand years, white peoples, usually called the Caucasians, subdivided into two or three subdivisions, the Northern Blondes, or Nordic race, an alleged intermediate race, about which many authorities are doubtful, the so-called Alpine race, and the Southern Dark Whites, the Mediterranean or Iberian race. Over Eastern Asia and America, a second group of races prevails, the Mongolians, generally with yellow skins, straight black hair and sturdy bodies, over Africa, the Negroes, and in the region of Australia and New Guinea, the black primitive Australoids. These are convenient terms, provided the student bears in mind that they're not exactly defined terms. They represent only the common characteristics of certain main groups of races. They leave out a number of little peoples who belong properly to none of these divisions, and they disregard the perpetual mixing where the main groups overlap. Third, the Mediterranean or Iberian division of the Caucasian race had a wider range in early times, and was a less specialized and distinctive type than the Nordic. It's very hard to define its southward boundaries from the Negro or to mark off its early traces in Central Asia from those of early Mongolians. Wilfred Scorn Blunt says that Huxley had long suspected a common origin of the Egyptians and the Dravidians of India, perhaps a long belt of brown-skinned men from India to Spain in very early days. It's possible that this belt of Huxley's of dark white and brown-skinned men, this race of brunette brown folk, ultimately spread even farther than India, that they reached to the shores of the Pacific, and that they were everywhere the original possessors of the Neolithic culture and the beginners of what we call civilization. It's possible that these brunette peoples are, so to speak, the basic peoples of our modern world, the Nordic and the Mongolian peoples may have been but northwestern and northeastern branches from this more fundamental stem. Or the Nordic race may have been a branch, while the Mongolian, like the Negro, may have been another equal and distinct stem from which the brunette browns met and mingled in South China. Or the Nordic peoples also may have developed separately from a Paleolithic stage. At some period in human history, see Eliot Smith's Migrations of Early Culture, there seems to have been a special type of Neolithic culture widely distributed in the world, which had a group of features so curious, and so unlikely to have been independently developed in different regions of the earth, as to compel us to believe that it was, in effect, one culture. It reached through all the regions inhabited by the brunette Mediterranean race, and beyond, through India. Further India, up the Pacific coast of China, and it spread at last across the Pacific and to Mexico and Peru. It was a coastal culture, not reaching deeply inland. This peculiar development of the Neolithic culture, which Eliot Smith called the Heliolithic culture, included many or all of the following odd practices. First, circumcision. Second, the very queer custom of sending the father to bed when a child is born, known as the couvade. Third, the practice of massage. Fourth, the making of mummies. Fifth, megalithic monuments, for example, Stonehenge. Sixth, artificial deformations of the heads of the young by bandages. Seventh, tattooing. Eighth, religious association of the sun and the serpent. And ninth, the use of the symbol known as the swastika for good luck. This odd little symbol spins gaily around the world. It seems incredible that men would have invented and made a pet of it twice over. Eliot Smith traces these associated practices in a sort of constellation all over this great Mediterranean, India, Ocean, Pacific area. Where one occurs, most of the others occur. They link Brittany with Borneo and Peru. But this constellation of practices doesn't crop up in the primitive homes of Nordic or Mongolian peoples, nor does it extend southward much beyond equatorial Africa. For thousands of years, from 15,000 to 1,000 BC, such a Heliolithic-Neolithic culture and its brownish possessors may have been oozing round the world through the warmer regions of the world, drifting by canoes, often across wide stretches of sea. It was then the highest culture in the world. It sustained the largest, most highly developed communities. And its region of origin may have been, as Eliot Smith suggests, the Mediterranean and North African region. It migrated slowly, age by age. It must have been spreading up the Pacific coast and across the island stepping stones to America long after it had passed on into other developments in its areas of origin. Many of the peoples of the East Indies, Melanesia and Polynesia, were still in this Heliolithic stage of development when they were discovered by European navigators in the 18th century. The first civilizations in Egypt and the Euphrates-Tigris Valley probably developed directly out of this widespread culture. We'll discuss later whether the Chinese civilization had a different origin. The Semitic nomads of the Arabian desert seem also to have had a Heliolithic stage.